Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today is March 5, 2026, and we are going to kick things off by having you do a little mental time travel.
Oh, nice. Where are we going?
I want you to picture yourself sitting in a standard examination room. You know, you are perched on the edge of that crinkly exam table paper.
Oh, yeah, we all know that exact sound.
Exactly. And a clinical technician hands you a plastic tube connected to a machine. You already know the drill. They tell you to take the absolute deepest breath your lungs can possibly hold
Right.
and then blow it all out as hard and as fast as humanly possible until you are practically dizzy.
It's an exhausting test, honestly.
It really is. But while you were sitting there afterward, you know, trying to catch your breath and waiting for the results, have you ever actually looked at that piece of equipment and wondered how that specific clinic decided to buy that specific machine?
It's a phenomenal question, really, because it highlights one of those invisible administrative decisions that completely shapes your healthcare experience.
Right, because you just see the device.
Exactly. You see the physical device sitting on the desk, but what you do not see is the massive mountain of operational variables, budget constraints, and clinical assumptions that led to it being placed in that exact room.
And that is the core mission of our deep dive today. We are pulling from a fascinating, just published industry guide from BOMAmed.
It's a great read.
Yeah, it is titled Choosing the Right Spirometry Equipment for Primary Care, Pulmonary Clinics, and Hospitals. And we are going straight into the hidden complexities of lung function testing.
Because it's a lot more complicated than just picking the most expensive box.
Totally. As the guide points out almost immediately, buying the most quote-unquote advanced medical device on the market is sometimes the absolute worst possible choice a clinic can make.
Which sounds wild, but equipment selection in modern medicine goes far beyond flipping through a catalog and picking the item with the most impressive technical specifications.
Yeah.
It's a highly complex puzzle. You are forcing human behavior, daily workflow routines, and sensor technology into a single purchasing decision.
And if they don't mesh,
Then, if any one of those pieces does not align with the reality of the clinic, the entire system breaks down and the data becomes useless.
okay, let's unpack this. Because the BOMAd guide makes a point early on that fundamentally changes how you look at clinical testing. We tend to think technical accuracy is the holy grail, right?
We assume the more precise the sensor, the better the medicine.
Right. But in the real world, absolute technical accuracy is almost entirely beside the point if the surrounding process is broken. The text explicitly states that when you get a bad spirometry result, the true culprit is almost never a faulty sensor.
Right, and what's fascinating here is the stark distinction they make between a device failure and a process failure.
Yeah, it's usually the process.
Exactly. The guide points out that the vast majority of failures in spirometry are process failures. It is rarely the technology breaking down. Instead, it is the human and environmental variables surrounding that technology that introduce the errors.
The guide flags a few very specific process failures, like poor coaching by the clinical staff, inconsistent effort from the patient.
Which happens a lot.
Definitely. And then weak discipline around device calibration and inadequate infection control routines.
When you think about what a forced exhalation test actually requires, it is essentially an athletic event.
It really is.
So if the human element fails, the sensor's accuracy is completely moot. The machine simply records what happens.
Right. It doesn't know you didn't try your hardest.
Precisely. If the clinical staff member does not adequately coach you through that intense maneuver, if they do not enthusiastically push you to keep blowing when your lungs feel empty, the data will reflect a poor effort, not your actual lung capacity.
Wow.
And if the clinic's routine for checking the acceptability of the test is inconsistent, the data they send to the physician is flawed. The most advanced microchips in the world cannot retroactively fix a bad coaching process.
So, for you listening, think about the real-world implications of that. The million-dollar medical device sitting in front of you is literally only as good as the human being standing next to you.
It's a sobering thought.
It is. If that staff member does not have the time or the proper software tools to guide you, the machine's technical specs are irrelevant. It might accurately record that you gave a terrible effort, leading a doctor to misdiagnose you with a restrictive lung disease, when in reality, you just needed someone to tell you to blow harder.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the BOMAmed text introduces a remarkably practical framework to prevent those exact scenarios. They argue that selection decisions should always be driven by three distinct forces.
and these forces apply everywhere.
They are ever-present, yes, but they carry vastly different weights depending on where the testing is actually happening.
The text breaks this down beautifully. The first force is clinical intent. A clinic has to ask, what is the actual medical purpose of this test in our specific building?
Are we just doing a quick baseline screening for a new patient?
Right. Or are we trying to make a highly concrete differential diagnosis for a complex respiratory issue? Or are we managing a known chronic condition, like COPD, longitudinally over the next 10 years?
That intent completely alters the requirement. And that leads directly into the second force, which is operational throughput.
How fast do you need to go?
Exactly. A private practice running maybe 5 tests a week has vastly different hardware and software needs than a busy hospital respiratory ward running 50 tests a day. You have to evaluate how fast you need to turn the room over and, critically, who exactly is pushing the buttons.
And the third force rounding out the framework is quality governance. This is the behind-the-scenes administrative layer that rarely gets talked about.
The boring but essential stuff.
Oh, absolutely. It involves how the clinic practically guarantees that a test is acceptable and repeatable. It covers the daily calibration protocols, the data security, and how the facility manages the reporting of that data back to the electronic health record.
When clinics ignore those three forces, they almost inevitably fall into a trap that the text brilliantly labels imagined future complexity.
This is such a great concept. It is the medical equivalent of buying a heavy-duty lifted 4x4 truck with a mechanical winch just to commute to an office job in the city, simply because you think you might want to go off-roading 5 years from now.
That is the perfect analogy.
The text warns that if a clinic doesn't define the exact questions the test must answer up front, they buy for this imagined future. They purchase the machine loaded with every bell and whistle, thinking it future-proofs their practice.
But the result of buying for imagined future complexity is universally disastrous in a clinical setting.
How so?
Well, they end up with a system that is drastically underused. It becomes incredibly slow for their simple daily needs, and it is usually poorly maintained because the calibration and cleaning protocols are too complicated for the general staff to manage.
It is a classic case of decision drift. The guide actually provides the specific scope questions clinics need to ask to avoid that decision drift. For example, they need to drill down and ask, are we primarily using this to assess standard asthma and COPD, or are we going to use it for highly regulated occupational surveillance?
Like clearing firefighters for duty, which has incredibly strict requirements.
Right, or maybe pre-op assessments before major surgeries.
Another crucial scope question involves demographics, particularly whether they need pediatric testing support. Testing a 6-year-old is a fundamentally different process than testing a 60-year-old adult.
I can imagine trying to get a kid to blow into a tube like that.
It's tough. So you have to ask, does the device offer interactive coaching tools, like visual animations of blowing out birthday candles on the screen, to keep a child engaged? Does the hardware accommodate the smaller mouthpieces necessary for pediatric airways?
They also have to ask if they need on-device interpretation aids, meaning the machine itself suggests a diagnosis, or if the raw data is going to be sent out and handled centrally by a specialized pulmonologist later on.
Answering all of these questions establishes a minimum feature set.
And once a clinic knows its exact scope, the staff does not get distracted by shiny, complex features that will only slow them down.
And that establishes one of the most counterintuitive points in the entire Belmebed guide.
Yeah, this blew my mind a little bit.
The clinical setting dictates the required features set to such an extreme degree that a spirometer considered the absolute gold standard in a specialized pulmonary lab can actually be a terrible, borderline dangerous choice for a primary care office.
This really illustrates why understanding the environment is everything. The guide divides the landscape into 3 distinct arenas: primary care, pulmonary clinics, and hospitals, because the environment completely changes the definition of what a good machine actually is.
So true.
In setting number 1, primary care, the chaos is the defining feature.
In a primary care environment, you have to look closely at the operator profile. The people running the spirometry tests are usually medical assistants, registered nurses, or general office staff.
And they are busy.
Their most defining characteristic is that they have incredibly limited time. They might be drawing blood, giving a vaccine, and running an EKG, all in the same 20-minute appointment block.
They simply cannot spend 15 minutes tinkering with a complex machine settings or trying to decipher raw waveforms.
Right.
The text emphasizes that primary care needs speed, simplicity, and incredibly fast setup.
Right.
But more importantly, because they are so rushed, their biggest operational failure mode is inadequate patient coaching.
So the device has to actively step in and compensate for that.
Exactly. It needs robust, automated quality prompts. It cannot just passively record a bad breath. It has to alert the medical assistant immediately, flag that the patient coughed or hesitated, and guide the operator toward a valid maneuver.
Now compare that environment to setting number two, pulmonary clinics. Here, the operator profile shifts entirely. You are dealing with dedicated pulmonary function test technologists or highly trained respiratory therapists.
This is all they do.
Yes, this specific test is their entire specialty. The patient volume is high, but unlike primary care, it is highly predictable and scheduled.
Since these are specialists, they do not need the machine to hold their hand with basic automated coaching prompts. Instead, the text points out they need tighter technical control over the hardware.
They require deep diagnostic capabilities.
Right. They rely on these tests as a diagnostic anchor for severe diseases. So they need high-quality flow-volume loop review. For those unfamiliar, a flow-volume loop is essentially the visual graph that maps exactly how fast and how much air is moving at every single millisecond of the breath.
It's highly detailed. Specialists need to analyze the specific shape of that curve to identify exactly where an airway is collapsing.
And they also require highly configurable predicted values. This means they need to adjust the baseline reference data to align with complex, specific clinical policies.
And because they are often staging a progressive disease like pulmonary fibrosis or tracking a patient's response to a new medication over 5 or 10 years, they desperately need robust longitudinal trending tools to reduce interpretive variability over time.
Makes total sense. Then we step into setting number three, hospitals and health systems. And the operational realities change once again. The operators here are still respiratory therapy staff, but they're working across multiple floors, across different wards, and across round-the-clock shifts.
Cross-coverage is incredibly common.
Right, meaning the therapist using the machine on Tuesday night might be completely different from the one using it Wednesday morning. Plus, the patient volume isn't just high, it's highly variable. It can spike dramatically with sudden seasonal respiratory loads, like a bad flu or RSV season.
A hospital environment demands absolute multi-user durability. The equipment is going to be handled by dozens of different people, dragged down long hallways, bumped into door frames, and cleaned constantly with harsh hospital-grade chemicals.
It takes a beating.
It really does. Furthermore, because of the much higher acuity, sicker populations in hospitals, strict, rigorous infection prevention isn't just a feature, it is paramount to the facility's safety.
The digital integration needs are also massive here. The hospital spirometer needs seamless, secure integration directly into the facility's electronic medical record system, as well as centralized calibration logging for strict compliance audits.
That traceability is huge.
A small primary care clinic might not need secure, role-based login access to operate their machine, but a massive hospital absolutely does, in order to maintain a clear chain of accountability across all those different staff members and shifts.
Here's where it gets really interesting.
I agree. The tech side is fascinating.
If we lift the hood on these devices, we find that most clinical buyers get completely distracted by the shiny user interface. You know, the high-resolution touchscreen, the sleek software design.
The stuff that looks good on a brochure.
Right. But the deeper, hidden driver of long-term measurement reliability is the physical sensor technology itself. How does the machine physically capture and quantify the air leaving your lungs?
The BOMAMED guide breaks down the most common measurement approaches in the industry, and it is clear there are distinct, unavoidable trade-offs for each. The first major category is the pneumatac sensor.
Which is a very common one.
Yeah. It calculates flow by measuring the differential pressure, essentially the pressure drop, as air passes through a slight resistance inside the tube. The text notes that this technology offers incredibly high fidelity and is widely accepted as a standard in rigorous clinical settings.
But the practical daily risk with the pneumatac is that the pressure sensors are highly sensitive to physical contamination.
They get dirty easily.
Very easily. They require very careful, methodical cleaning and incredibly strict calibration discipline. Because of that high maintenance burden, a pneumatac is usually a best fit for specialized pulmonary clinics or hospitals where they actually have the dedicated respiratory staff to manage that constant upkeep without cutting corners.
Wait, that brings up an interesting point about this second category. Turbine sensors.
Ah!
These are highly portable, mechanically simple, and often much lower in cost. You see these a lot in local primary care or mobile screening programs. But the text notes that turbines actually have tiny physical moving parts, a little fan blade that spins as you blow.
They do.
So if they have moving parts and patients are constantly blowing highly humidified air, moisture, and secretions right into them, why would a clinic choose them over something solid state? Wouldn't the mechanical wear and tear make them inherently less reliable?
That is exactly the friction point many procurement teams face. Turbines do face mechanical wear, and they can be affected by that moisture and changes in air resistance.
So why use them?
Well, the guide includes a crucial caveat in its Q&A section regarding this trade-off. It notes that portable spirometry, like these turbine models, can still be highly reliable for making clinical decisions, provided the cost and portability benefits allow the clinic to actually perform the tests.
So having a test is better than no test.
Exactly. The key is that the specific device must have rigorous software quality prompts to catch errors, and the clinic must maintain consistent operator technique and verification routines to ensure the turbine hasn't degraded.
Then you have the third major category, ultrasonic sensors. The massive selling point here is that they use high-frequency sound waves to measure the transit time of the air.
Which means no moving parts.
Zero moving parts, which makes them highly stable over long periods of time. But the trade-off is that sound waves are affected by the environment.
They are very sensitive to ambient conditions.
Right. The device requires complex environmental compensation. It has to constantly adjust for the temperature, the humidity, and the ambient pressure in the room. Its performance really relies on how flawlessly the manufacturer implemented that compensation technology.
This raises an important question.
Okay, what is it?
When a clinic's purchasing committee sits down to evaluate these different sensors, they almost always ask, which sensor technology is simply the best? But the BombyMed guide completely reframes this entire debate.
Because best is relative.
Exactly. The real question is not which sensor is best. The question a clinic must ruthlessly ask themselves is, which sensor technology is least likely to degrade in quality under our specific real-world staffing model and our actual daily cleaning realities?
That is such a crucial distinction. It stops being an engineering debate and becomes a human behavior debate.
It really does.
And speaking of the daily realities of human behavior in a clinic, the guide makes a very strong, uncompromising point about standards and calibration. It argues that aligning with international thoracic standards isn't just a clinical afterthought to be checked off, it is a hard, non-negotiable purchasing requirement.
Absolutely. The entire quality foundation of a spirometry program depends entirely on routine, provable verification.
You have to prove it works every day.
If a clinic cannot mathematically prove the device is accurate today, the data it generates is effectively useless for diagnosing a patient. So the physical equipment choice must seamlessly and easily support a consistent calibration verification routine.
The text gives a fantastic specific detail on what this actually looks like in practice. It says the equipment must actively support a daily calibration workflow using a 3L syringe.
This is a vital piece of the puzzle.
So if you are listening, try to imagine a massive, highly precision machined mechanical plunger, exactly 3 liters in volume. Every single morning, a staff member has to manually pump this giant syringe to push a perfectly known volume of air into the machine to ensure the sensor is reading exactly 3.00 liters.
And it has to be done carefully.
Right. If the device's software or physical design makes this daily verification process tedious or difficult, human nature takes over. The clinic's compliance will erode, staff will skip the calibration, and the patient results will silently become undependable.
And we cannot discuss these daily physical routines without addressing the critical issue of infection control. The guide emphasizes heavily that infection control must be viewed as a core part of the physical equipment design and selection process.
It can't just be an afterthought.
It cannot just be a separate clinic policy written in a binder somewhere in the manager's office.
Right, because think about what spirometry actually is physically. It involves maximal forced exhalation. You are forcing air from deep inside your lungs out into the open room, which inherently raises the stakes for aerosolizing particles and cross-contamination.
The physical design of the device dictates exactly how safely this procedure can be done in a busy room.
The guide details several key selection criteria regarding this hygiene aspect. For instance, the system absolutely must be compatible with single-use bacterial and viral filters.
That's non-negotiable.
But the nuance is that it is not enough to simply jam a filter onto the end of a tube. The device must be natively designed so that adding the physical resistance of that filter does not distort the airflow or artificially change the volume measurements the sensor is capturing.
Because the filter adds drag.
Exactly. They also highlight the need for a stable, cost-effective supply chain ecosystem of disposable mouthpieces. And here's a fascinating, highly specific technical detail from the guide.
I love this part.
The equipment manufacturer needs to provide explicit, clear guidance on whether that daily 3L syringe calibration we just talked about should be performed with the disposable filter already in place.
It sounds like a tiny detail, but it matters.
If the staff calibrates the machine without the filter, but tests the patient with the filter, they have introduced a tiny variable that skews the data. Every little variable matters when you are measuring fractions of a liter.
It truly does. Furthermore, the external surfaces of the machine must be easy to wipe down rapidly between patients without degrading the plastics.
Those medical wipes are harsh.
Very harsh. And the delicate internal electronic components must be completely protected from contamination through proper physical interface design. If a machine's complex design requires an exhausted medical assistant to take complicated shortcuts just to keep it clean, the infection control protocol will eventually fail.
So what does this all mean?
Good question.
When you step back and look at the entirety of the Bomosin guide, a very clear, defining core philosophy emerges. Thriving, accurate spirometry programs do not just buy a machine based on a spec sheet. They treat equipment selection as a true, comprehensive systems decision.
They do. Because measurement reliability, the human element of patient coaching, the rigorous demands of infection control, and the seamless flow of digital data cannot be treated as separate silos.
They're all connected.
They must all actively reinforce each other. The technology has to be designed to support the operator's workflow. The operator has to be freed up to support the patient's effort, and the daily physical routines have to support the hygiene and the mathematical accuracy of the device.
The text features a fantastic concluding remark. It states that as respiratory care becomes more integrated into general practice, the most valuable equipment on the market will be the systems that make high-quality testing easier to perform than low-quality testing.
That is a brilliant way to phrase it.
That really sums up the ultimate goal, doesn't it? Making the absolute right way to do something the easiest possible way to do it.
It is a profound engineering goal. It's a fascinating lens to view the future of healthcare through.
How so?
Well, we spend so much time in the public discourse worrying about the advanced artificial intelligence or the sheer processing power of the microchips inside our medical technology.
That's a flashy stuff.
But perhaps the real revolution in everyday medicine won't actually be a smarter computer algorithm. Maybe the real revolution will simply be physical hardware and workflow designs that make human error practically impossible to commit. If the future of medicine relies on designing devices that make doing the right thing the path of least resistance, how might this philosophy of designing out human error completely reshape the everyday medical devices you encounter during your next routine checkup?
That is something to think about. Next time you find yourself sitting on that crinkly exam table, take a much closer look at the seemingly ordinary machines around you. There is a whole world of invisible decisions sitting right there on the desk. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the hidden systems that shape our healthcare. We will catch you next time.